music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Welcome to Intravenous on CJSF 90.1 FM, campus and community radio from Burnaby Mountain, where we do broadcast on the unceded ancestral territories of the Coquitlam, the Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh peoples. My name's Robin, and I am the host for today's show. And I am joined by Dr. Alexandra Lysova, am I pronouncing it right? who is a professor of criminology here at SFU and has been studying intimate partner violence, male and female victimization and offending, and homicide for the past 20 years. Dr. Lysova is the 2022 recipient of the Nora and Ted Sterling Prize in support of controversy for her years of dedicated research in a field that can sometimes be fraught with polarizing and politicized debate, especially with the focus of her work being on male victims of domestic violence. I'm so happy to have a conversation with you, Alexandra. I think this will be really interesting for our audience. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Robin, for having me.
I want to start by learning where and how your research interest started.
Yes, thank you for this question. I was an undergraduate student in psychology at the Far Eastern State University in Vladivostok, Russia. And I was very much interested in family communication. And then one of the professors who traveled to the United States mentioned the issue of family violence. At that time, in the 90s, this topic was quite new for Russia, and not that many people discussed domestic violence or family violence. So I was immediately intrigued. I was very interested in understanding what it is and why it happens, particularly because I come from a loving and caring family. And my understanding was that people come together, have children, and I didn't understand how it is possible that people can hurt each other that much. So that was my original interest in looking into the family violence. And then, of course, specifically that we didn't have much information, no service, no books. I tried to get any translated materials from the West about the domestic violence, and what I could find was violence against women literature. So that was the campaign that started in the United States, Canada, Western Europe in the 70s and 80s. And some of the materials were available, translated into Russian, but there was no really broad discussion in the society about this issue at that time. I guess that's what why I became interested in this issue in the first place. And then, of course, while I graduated from the university, I entered the graduate school with a direct idea that I will be studying family violence. And I actually specifically focused on dating violence in Russia. I was very interested in understanding how it all starts. And when I got, I received several very good grants while I was the graduate student. I received a Canon Scholar Grant and had an opportunity to go to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., which is a direct program that supports working at the Library of Congress with any sources you can get. And this is where I read most of the information about what is domestic violence, the theories of why it happens, the spread of it in other countries where it was studied. It was very, very important experience for me. And then in 2004, I was very honored to receive a Fulbright scholarship from Russia to the United States. And I did my research at New York University and met several very powerful and very very strong researchers in family violence field, Linda Mills, the professor from New York University, and Mary Strauss, professor of sociology from University of New Hampshire. And these people very much impacted my future career, because this is how I received access to the networks of people who worked on family violence. I learned about the challenges to the field in the West. And when I came back to Russia, I continued my research. I did the national study of violence against women in Russia in 2008. I published this in the paper where I analyzed different risk factors for violence against women in Russia. I mostly focused on violence against women and children. I also joined a big study on corporal punishment of children, because I found this topic extremely, extremely important. It's not directly abuse, but this is something what people, parents, consider normal, legal. They consider it appropriate to physically punish children, and they don't see that as something that should stop. So I found it very interesting, because I personally saw parents physically punishing their children on the streets in Russia, and I was wondering what the scope of it and what we could do to prevent this from happening. So that was my original interest in Russia, dating violence, violence against women, violence against children, specifically with the focus on corporal punishment. And then the more I read, the more I learned about domestic violence, I've learned that these are not the only victims. Yeah, and this is where I realized that domestic violence is such an extremely complex phenomenon, and we should not split it into the parts like violence against women, right? So, or violence against men. These are the parts of the very complex issue. And since we're talking about the intimate relationships where people come together and related on so many different levels, we're missing something if we keep conceptualizing family violence as violence against women only. Violence against women is an extremely important issue. And thanks to the feminist researchers, feminist advocates, in the 70s, in the 80s, last century, there was so much done to bring attention to family violence, violence against women, violence against girls in the families and in the society. But then I think right now we've reached the point when we've amassed so much knowledge about what violence in the families is, and we see how difficult, complex it is. For example, what we know from the meta-analysis studies that summarize most of the research in the area of family violence is that the majority, around 60% of the couples that experience violence, experience it bidirectionally. So majority of violence, in fact, is when it goes both ways, not necessarily in the same situation, which is called mutual violence, but at different points, partners can use violence and abuse against each other. And that's about 60% of all couples. We know that other proportion of these couples are when the women only use violence. And then the third share of all the violent couples is when only men are violent and the female partner is not aggressive and is not controlling. So this was eye-opening for me. And this is where I realized that we should not compartmentalize. We should not see this as a fractured research. It's just violence against women or violence against men. We, in fact, need to try to see that as a very complex, intertwined phenomenon when both partners play a very important role. And that is why the programs for prevention for domestic violence should actually be focused on the couple, on the relationship, right? There are definitely relationships and couples when only one partner is abusive and controlling. It can be a man, it can be a woman. And in these couples, indeed, the prevention treatment should be directed at one partner primarily, right? Because they actually aggressive due to controlling and dominant views, very strict gender views. They also can have mental illness, or they have may some substance use issues. So in this case, we need to focus on the individual. Again, if it can be a woman or it can be a man. But in the majority of the couples, we're actually seeing that this is very bi-directional phenomenon, and we need to focus on the communication between two partners. And we should not forget that there are children in the relationship in many of these couples, and children suffer a lot when they directly imposed to violence, when they indirectly witness or hear the abuse happening between the parents. They suffer a lot psychologically, cognitively, emotionally. And we should understand that domestic violence, what I understand it now, is not that much a gender issue. It's more a human issue. It can be any gender who is affected by violence. And if we understand that and feel empathy for all victims, regardless of the gender, we actually will be so much better at preventing violence that is so traumatic for everybody who's involved.
Yes, indeed. I'm surprised to hear the statistics, you know, that 60% of couples are mutually in it together, right? And I guess the question that I have is, how does male victimization look like in contrast to women's? Because, you know, maybe that helps us understand and appreciate what it means, and, you know, how it goes unrecognized.
Mm-hmm. First of all, there are many similarities, and there is an overlap between the types of victimization, frequency of victimization between men and women. And hopefully soon my paper will come out in the Journal of Family Violence that is called Similar but Different. So that's exactly towards your question about the similarities and differences between the men's and women's experiences of victimization. So while there are similarities, and we know that now that men and women experience, first of all, broad range of abusive acts, including physical violence, psychological violence, controlling behaviors, sexual abuse. Men also experience sexual abuse. We learn it from the focus groups, from the interviews and surveys. So they all experience this. We also know that the consequences of abuse are traumatic, very much traumatic for both men and women. We hear more of the voices of women. We know more about it because there is more published research. There are more programs, more all kind of the movies, documentaries about women's experiences of abuse. But we almost do not hear how men experience abuse. And I've realized that not many researchers even asked these questions to the men. For example, World Health Organization still has, they have a department that focuses on domestic violence and family violence. I use them interchangeably, these two terms, in the world. And they ask questions about victimization in domestic relationship only to women. And I, when I approach them and ask them, why don't you ask men about experiences of victimization? And basically, there was no clear answer. They cited some budget limitations. I think there is something else here too. And mainly this idea that maybe men just don't experience violence that seriously as women. We do not hear men's voices that often. Maybe they just don't like it. Or as I've seen on one poster about boys' experiences of sexual abuse, maybe they like it. Some people believe so. Yeah, so this can be that terrible as that. So yes, so what we find is that similarity between the experiences of men and women is that men and women both experiences as a very traumatic event. They experience serious consequences, emotional consequences, something very similar to post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, difficulties with sleeping, difficulties coming to the places where the violence happened, and so on. So men experiences. So, however, at the same time, there are actually differences. And differences are vast. So women are much more likely to experience sexual abuse than men. We do not, in intimate relationship, it doesn't mean that men do not experience sexual abuse. We know about the cases when men are forced to perform sexually, when they don't want that, against their will. So all kind of different experiences happen, particularly in same-sex couples. What we also know is that women are much more likely to experience the most severe forms of abuse, including intimate partner homicide. And these statistics, usually cited to explain why we should focus on women rather than men. And that is why those who discuss issues of violence against women, they mostly use police data. And police data registers the tip of the iceberg, the most serious crimes committed against women in the relationship. And the numbers are much higher for women who suffer the most serious types of abuse than for men. However, when we look at the general population surveys, it's not the police data, it's then each one of us in Canada have an equal chance to get into the survey and answer the questions about the conflicts in the relationships. And when we look at that data, we see that the numbers between men and women are very, very similar. In fact, in 2014, if you approach Family Violence in Canada report online, prepared by Statistics Canada, you see that the number of men was higher in 2014 for men than for women. This is something eye-opening, of course, that was for me when I've learned that. I've looked into the data myself specifically. But what I wanted to say is that the difference for women still is that women experience the most severe forms of abuse, like homicide. As for the men also have very gender-specific experiences of abuse. What we know, the men are more likely to experience, or most likely experience, psychological abuse and controlling behaviors. And this is what they cite as the most traumatic forms of victimization in the relationship. And when people think about men, and they, particularly when they doubt that the men victims exist, they immediately think about the man being physically abused somewhere, laying in the pool of blood somewhere, and then they think it's just unlikely that it can happen. In fact, most of the victimization for men happens in the form of the psychological abuse and controlling behaviors that we know from the feminist research are very serious forms of abuse against women, right? And this is something that can hurt so much more even than the physical abuse. This is what we know from the literature. So men experience these forms. They are invisible. It's hard to prove them. Men do not call the police often when they experience this. And that is why they're not in the police data. So this is how they're not represented in the statistics that we see. Even though many of them suffer tremendously, right? There is a terrible pain related to this violence. There is also another gender-specific form of abuse experienced by men. We've just recently learning about it. And this is legal and administrative abuse. So what is it? This is when their partner, intimate partner, very often female partner, threatens or actually uses criminal justice system, child protective services, family justice system against the partner. So how does it look like? It looks like a false accusation of abuse. For example, if you only tell anybody, or if you call the police, I will tell the police that you hurt me or you abused a child. And I don't need to prove that much. So they prepare to consider me as a victim, but you will go to prison and you will not see your child again. And this is how the threats look like. And many men, this is what keep this man in the relationship. They're silent and they're afraid. And some of those who tried actually realize the system indeed works against them. So this is one of the very serious, very specific forms of abuse. It doesn't mean that women do not suffer from this abuse. Women do experience this abuse as well. But what we learn from men, and we need to continue studies to compare the rates, the prevalence of this victimization among men and women, But what I hear from men when I interview them, I talk to them in focus groups, it looks like this is what bothers them a lot. What is also interesting is that there are many issues with children, of course, and we know a lot about violence against children in the relationship when women are abused. We almost hear nothing about men who actually are abused men and who live with their children in the families. How do they experience abuse? And we know now more that children are used as a weapon against the men. They stay for children because they don't want them to be hurt. They want to be there to protect them, even though in expense, just understanding that they will be directly impacted by abuse as well. So there are so many interesting issues that we're learning right now, and we see both similarities and differences, which of course leads us to the very important implications for treatment and policies and prevention, in a way that we need to understand gender-specific experiences of abuse, and we need to treat these victims similarly but different. And practitioners should be prepared to talk to men. We also know, by the way, it's interesting that men do not like the word victim. They would not apply it to themselves. They don't like the word survivor as well. So you see, this is one of the interesting issues. We keep just calling them, no, admit you're a victim, admit, it's not gonna work. They don't want that. So that's something we need to develop, a language that the man will feel comfortable using towards themselves. They still want to be in control, you know, due to their gender socialization roles. And we need to find a way really to train professionals to use that language that is helpful for victims and help them review the experiences of abuse and deal with them.
That really leads into my next question, which is, how or why do you think we as a society are so reluctant to address this aspect of intimate partner violence? And, you know, of course, not having the language or not being comfortable with the language is a good start, but I'm sure there's more.
Yes. There are several major reasons for the society not to be ready for male victims. One of them, and one of the most powerful one, is that the men do not fit the image of the perfect victim, using criminological language. So the perfect victim in criminology is a helpless individual, somebody who is vulnerable and need our help. And most of these victims, in our opinion, are children. They need our help. They cannot protect themselves. They need our help. They are perfect victims, as well as older individuals, also minorities, also women. And men are just not there. Men do not fit that image of the perfect victim because we think about men as dominant, as strong, as controlling type, having most of the resources in this world. What kind of help do they need? They can help themselves. So that's the idea. We don't have this empathy in the first place in the society to treat men as deserving our attention or actually who can be vulnerable. And of course, this is wrong because not all men are the same. Men as women are not the homogeneous group. There are so many different men. Some of them are powerful and controlling, and some are actually very vulnerable and need our help. And this can be younger men, older men, immigrant men, men with mental health disorder, all kind of men. All men are just shy, who are just not that assertive or dominant, just regular, normal men, but who just experience issues, right? So they need our help. So that's where we see this, one of the barriers to accepting men and or realizing that the men can be victims in our society. Another barrier, a serious one, is actually the family violence area itself in criminology and in sociology and social work psychology. The main theories that were set up to explain family violence were proposed by the feminist researchers. And these theories are gender-based theories. or they're called violence against women or feminist theories, and they focus on women as victims, and they focus on men as perpetrators or offenders. So the entire field was conceptualized to see men as perpetrators. These theories still have issues with seeing men as victims. It's mostly women who are seen as victims and men as perpetrators. Again, this is really important because it's so strong in the field. So this is where we feel a lot of resistance breaking through these theories and even proposing new theories that will be more gender inclusive, right? I can give you just one example. While women perpetrate violence in the relationship, there is a lot of attention to the prior victimization of women, somewhere the early childhood experiences, physical abuse or sexual abuse, that would explain why they would be violent. And then, of course, there was a lot of explanation coming from violence in those relationships. So women would not hurt just because they wouldn't. If they hurt their partner, it's because probably they were victimized first. And there is this term, battered women syndrome. So when women actually suffered years of abuse, and then they will hurt or even kill the partner, because it's a revenge, it's a resistance to abuse. So we always see women's experiences with perpetration of abuse through the lenses of their victimization, some prior experience of victimization. While when it comes to men, we do not see that. Men's violence is explained almost purely in terms of their own responsibility, motivation to control and dominate. And when I look, so many studies today find that childhood experiences of victimization in men is a very strong predictive factor for their perpetration of violence against an intimate partner. When they were boys, they were severely abused in their families. Many of them experienced trauma, also stranger abuse. They witnessed a lot of violence. They come from poor areas. But no, these factors are not really considered explanatory, because again, the entire agenda was to look at them as perpetrators and bring this responsibility on them rather than try to find an explanation in the past and help them in the past. That is why I think it's so important to do this research, because we will be so much better at preventing violence by men if we look at where it comes from in the first place, rather than strictly following the theory and saying it's their responsibility. We have to bring them to the Batterer intervention program, change their views on women, and everything will be solved. We know now that Batterer intervention programs, the effectiveness is around zero. There is something else that we're missing. Why don't we look at the experiences of violence by this man? And I call it this issue polyvictimization. It's a very important topic in, you know, in social work, in criminology, in psychology. Polyvictimization is when the individuals experience different types of violence in their lives. And they actually, we find that the consequences of these abuse are much more severe, that even if it's one type of violence perpetrated against an individual, these are different types of victimization happening over and over again in the person's life. And that can explain why some of them may just develop these attitudes, and some of them do not have models to behave with an individual, with the intimate partner. So it's very important that we have to treat that mental trauma and deal with that victimization in the past in order to prevent better the perpetration of abuse by men in the relationship. Again, the example might was that in feminist theories, we do not really see that much focus on victimization experiences of men. And that is why I think they are limited at this point to really acknowledge the complexity of intimate partner violence. This is kind of number two. And of course, number three, one of the factors that prevent us from treating men as victims is gender socialization. We still have very strong attitudes about how men, women, boys and girls should be socialized. There is still a double standard in many families in seeing the man as strong, as dominant, and boys never cry. So we actually come to the point when boys are not encouraged to show their emotions. They don't know what to do with the emotions when they feel bad, depressed, sad. They hide it. They hide it. And then, of course, since I'm interested very much in learning about intimate partner homicide, what do we see? Majority of the male perpetrators of intimate partner homicide, those who killed their female partners, were individuals with a depression. So the point is, how can we prevent intimate partner homicides against women? Is one way to treat the men. To treat the men when they have the depression and they hide it. They do not reveal it. They don't go to doctors. They don't talk to anybody. They feel embarrassed and shamed to even mention it to anybody. So this is one already, the prevention of violence against women and children in the family, because we know that when these individuals kill, in 25% of cases, then they kill themselves. It's called a homicide-suicide phenomenon. So the entire family actually is just, annihilated, affected, right? So that's a big tragedy that in some cases can be prevented. So that is why I think these are the major reasons why our society still has these issues with acknowledging men as victims.
I think we're also starting to see why this research is considered controversial in terms of, the social narrative that is out there and how attached it is to, these theories and these policies that already exist, as you were outlining. How has your own belief system or value system shifted or changed as a result of your research?
In several ways. It changed in several ways. When I first started to look into male victims of intimate partner violence, I didn't realize how widespread this issue is. I did not know. Similar to many people, I did not hear voices of men. I did not read much about men's experiences of abuse. And then when I talked to men, it was definitely so much revealed to me how much they experience of abuse and how much they suffer in the result of this abuse. So that was somewhat someone that affected me much as well. As a researcher, it very much expanded my views on the complexities and traumatic experiences of abuse for all the victims involved. And what was also interesting to see that general social survey on victimization conducted by Statistics Canada, the one I've already mentioned about, found how many male victims are in Canada. And we get these studies right now from the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, Germany. We see in so many countries, men suffer from domestic violence, and it's not a rare phenomenon. It's not an exceptional case of just a couple of men. And this is what I've read in the feminist literature that, just maybe there are women who are intimate terrorists. So intimate terrorism is the type of abuse which is the most serious forms of abuse in Michael Johnson's typology, where the one partner is violent and controlling and another partner is not violent, not controlling. And in his book, when he discussed different typologies of abuse, he said, even if there are some female intimate terrorists, it's probably just a few of them. It's a very rare phenomenon when men can be abused like this. And of course, when we do our research and we focus and we actually talk to men, we found out that it's not a rare phenomenon at all. So many men suffer. Again, we just don't hear their voices. They're embarrassed, they're ashamed, they don't go where. And actually, it's not that much they can go to. Some of those who told us that they tried to find help, they were not successful with this because many helplines, telephone helplines are geared especially for female victims, and men were turned away. They were said that, sorry, we cannot help you, find something else. Many shelters are just designed for women and children and not for men and children. So men just cannot get help, right? So again, we do not hear their voices. So that was something very much revealing. Another important aspect of family violence that that I've realized something that changed in me, something that I've learned so much more when I looked at male victimization was, of course, acknowledging the complexity of intimate partner violence, how victimization and perpetration are intertwined in the intimate relationship. Something that we, I think, still underestimate. We still think about this as by the way, in criminal justice system terms, in the criminal justice system, there is a perpetrator and there is a victim. And this is how we think about it. So when the police come, what happens? They are expected to arrest somebody, and somebody should be a victim or somebody should be a perpetrator. And what I found is that it's just not that clear in family violence who is the perpetrator and should be arrested and who is the victim and should be helped. What we find is that there's both of them actually participated in the abuse. If this time it was a man who was abusive, the week before it was a woman who was abusive. And it can be in the situation then both of them are abusive. So it's a very difficult job for the police to at that time to decide who to arrest. Particularly in the many countries, there are laws, mandatory arrest laws or pro-arrest policies when they actually have to arrest somebody if they believe there is a reason that violence took place. And they have very difficult jobs to understand who it is. So what I'm saying is this is another very important insight for me to understand that we actually need to look at this as a complex phenomenon and more from the relational point of view rather than individual point of view, or even this kind of group thinking by gender, women against men, men against women. It's so much more than that. And what we also find interesting in the intimate relationship, when the police actually tries to arrest a man, women don't want that. Some women don't want that. They actually say, please don't do that, because he's a provider for a family. I still love him. I just want violence to stop. I don't want him to go to prison and affect his employment. Please stop. Don't do that. So what happens is that we find that in the states, in the United States, where the mandatory laws were applied, what happened, women stopped calling the police because they don't want the police come and take, you know, freedom, their choice from their hands and just, you know, punishing their partner with whom they still feel something and love and the father for their children. So that's how complex it is, right? So this is immensely difficult. And this is something I realized over the years of my research.
Oh, I just, you know, the more you describe the things that you've learned and, you know, uncovered about this issue and talk about the complexities, it really does start to unravel how the intersections of these belief systems that we have as a society, but also, you know, the conditionings of gender roles and the expectations and, you know, how we perceive things just all gets mixed up into the pot and really explains a lot about how the barriers that discourage men from coming forward about abuse start to show themselves, right?
Yeah, there are so many barriers due to socialization, due to this image of the perfect victim, to the language that we have for the victim. It's just they're just not prepared. They're not encouraged. They don't think anybody's interested in hearing this story, and they don't want to complain. We know that from a very rich psychological literature, men even less likely to go to doctors when they feel sick than women. Women much more likely to go and look for help with their friends and families and doctors. Men don't, unless they feel really bad. So that's the similar situation with abuse. They wait until the last moment. And the men I talked to told me that they felt very, very sorry for the years of abuse they experienced and kind of a loss for them, right? And they said, why didn't I do something earlier? Why didn't I realize that that was not healthy? Because men, what they do, one of the barriers for them to seek help is that they rationalize what happens to them as something normal. Maybe marriages look like that. And then maybe she's just experiencing some problems and it will go away. She has some substance issue. Oh, she was a victim in her family. And then they find all kind of explanations and this and put up with the abuse for years and years before they actually find out that the way they were treated is wrong. And that's what we call abuse. The men don't call it the abuse. And that's a very important issue with men, you know, not seeking help, because they don't even call it abuse in the first place. They don't admit that they're victims of abuse, right? And it was interesting to hear some men say, and I was hit like this, and I was controlled, and I was, and then she you know, slapped me here and there, but no, I'm not a victim. And we said, but don't you think that what you experienced was abuse? And only then they kind of realize that, yes, so you need, that is very important to have the, this conversation in our society, maybe early education programs, when we actually teach both boys and girls how to have healthy relationship, that violence is not, it's not only for men to stop their violence, it's also for women to stop their abuse and violence. Both genders are capable of that. They do it a bit differently due to different evolutionary theories, but they do it. The motives are there and the ways are there. So, and that is why I think it's so important to talk about men's victimization in the context of violent relationship, of course, in the context of female victimization and female violence, is just because it's, if we help men, we actually will be able to prevent more violence against women and children. Just because when women are violent or abusive, if they humiliate the partner in the presence of the children, calling him different names, that's wrong. If they think that they come and hit the man or throw something at him and think it's perfectly fine, it's just a woman's type of communication, that's wrong. Because nobody likes to be hit. Nobody likes to be humiliated. And they feel bad about it. And that may cause a male partner to be engaged in this violent communication. And this is how it starts. Of course, there are some men who start this communication, and this is how it starts. So I think we need to, at this point, to look more, not that much at the gender issue as a gendered issue, a more as a human issue, as a problem when both men and women, boys and girls, can be involved in the relationship that's so violent and toxic. And I think I've just remembered about a Johnny Depp case with Amber Heard. And I think that was very revealing to see that even an actor, a Hollywood actor, could be treated like this in his relationship, abused physically and psychologically. And he was abusive as well, according to Amber Heard testimony. So these are the relationship, what I've described before, it's bidirectional violence. And this is, again, the majority of relationship like this. So we need to focus on this type of relationship as well, in addition to very severe cases of abuse. But what I believe in right now, and what I'm looking at in my research currently, is what types of relationship, abusive relationship, are more likely to lead to homicide and the most severe abuse that women tend to experience. How can we stop that from escalating to more and more severe forms when actual women end up being killed? And I think it's very important to look at the dynamic of relationship, not just at the man who should be treated and changed. Yes, some of the men, absolutely. And some of the relationship, as I've mentioned, some men should be the focus of the treatment. But in the many couples, it's actually both. So that is why I think what my research is doing, it's just not presenting something different instead of what it was before. It's in addition to what we've learned before, building on the very important feminist work and feminist theorizing. We just right now, with new data, we're just adding a much more complex picture. And what I tell my students in my family violence class at SFU is that we probably should not look for the simplicity, black or white, guilty or not guilty, or something like this. In family violence, it does not work. What will work is actually acknowledging and recognizing the complexity, nuances. And only when we looked into the very different types of intimate relationship, when the violence can happen, we can develop different programs of intervention for different types of relationship. So it's not just everything one size fits all. Right, all violence is just because it's patriarchal, dominant men who abuse women. It's not. We do not see that. It's not supported by empirical data that we have. it does not work. We're not good at really preventing domestic homicide. It stays, it remains at the same level in the past 15 years. Something clearly does not work. So maybe we should also look at the complexity of the relationship and treat these very different couples, screen them for the type of abuse they experience and help them specifically for that type of abuse. And if it's both men and women who experience abuse, maybe couple therapy would be more appropriate. If it's only one partner who is abusive and controlling, then focusing on that individual will help, right? So seeing more complexity may be the way to really deal with this more effectively. And of course, including the focus on male victims. And it is a controversial topic. It's very unfortunate. It's controversial. I don't see this controversial. I don't think it's controversial. Why is it controversial? It's just victims who suffer in the relationship. So we need to treat them that way. And I've just explained the reasons for why we do not feel that much empathy for men. We do not think of them as a perfect victim. We tend to think about them as all men in power with patriarchy, but not all of men are like this. And it's very sad that we need to go through this, get through this same kind of resistance in the society and in the research area and academia to really reveal how deep these victimizations are and that we actually deal with the same phenomenon. We want to save lives. We want to make our societies happy and families happier. And again, we should not forget about children who are in this relationship. For their psychological help, cognitive help, physical health, it does not matter who is the abuser. If it's a woman, the effect on children's development is the same detrimental effect. So we need to stop any violence from any partner if that partner is violent, right? And if it's both of them violent, we need to try to prevent that or stop that violence from happening. So that is why, again, more complexity, and it's very unfortunate it's seen as controversial.
It is unfortunate, especially hearing the way that you're explaining the dance of it all, you know, mm-hmm. and the relationality. You did address a little bit some of the challenges that you face in putting this research out there, but are there other challenges that you see or that you've faced, and how are you, coming up ahead of those?
Yes, unfortunately, there are challenges. The reason for that challenges are mostly that we're seen as perceived as going against the paradigm that explained gender-based violence that is so strong in our field in criminology and sociology. Some of the challenges, specific challenges, are that there is a double standard to our publications. For example, some of our manuscripts are rejected and the comments mostly about the topic. And it's not that much about methodology or theory, or sometimes it's just nothing about methodology or theory. It's mostly about why don't you do some other topic? Or why don't you include female victims as well? So this is what we find consistently. I communicate with my scholars in different countries, and this is the comment we find, the most common one. So the research on male victims specifically is challenged on a way that it's only men. It's just not enough to discuss the men. You need to include women as well as victims. And this is interesting because when we look at the violence against women literature, we do not see that much of different groups there. It's just women. You focus on women, and it sounds valid and important. Once we talk about men, it seems not enough. It's just not convincing enough that they deserve that much attention and should be compared to women's experiences of abuse. So this is one of the common things. And of course, grant applications. That's so unfortunate that all of us in this field have to, we understand that. We will not be getting grants for focusing on male victims. We have to develop something what the reviewers want, and they want usually that we follow some expectations in the field. So that's very sad because for me, coming from Russia to Canada and believing in academic freedom and merit-based research that is just based on the idea, and if you develop this study using sound methodology and theory, that's important. But when I sense and see how much something is corrected ideologically, that saddens me very much. I've seen that in Russia, so it's very sad to hear this, to see this in Western countries, including Canada. And one of the issues I think is just employment. So some of our graduates may face some issues with getting hired at some universities where there are people who strongly believe against considering male victims. So that's another issue. And they are brave, and I very much praise our students who are not afraid and who go to this field knowing that they may face challenges. So yes, this is very sad that that happens today.
Just looking at the clock, the time for these conversations always flies by, and I want to just give you an opportunity, you know, if there's anything that seems like it's hanging or I've missed asking you about, that you can comment on, and also let our audience know where they can find out more information and perhaps if you have resources to share for people who this might be really resonating with in our audience, also if there are directions you can point people to.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. Couple of things to add. It's just my hope is that one day, very soon, it will stop being a controversial topic and it will be more accepted in the research community. And we will just do our job focusing on the research question rather than on fighting some ideological wars on who is deserving more attention. And that we will also develop with the men sharing their stories more openly, more men will hear them and will be very much impacted by that. And they will be seeking help earlier and they will be leaving abusive relationships earlier, so that we'll have more healthy families and healthy couples. And that in the society, we will reach some level of empathy towards all victims, regardless of gender. And our treatment programs and professionals working in the field will use more gender-inclusive language and gender-inclusive treatment programs. So regardless of the gender of the victim, they will feel equally warm and supportive of them, you know, without all the suspicions and, you know, blaming the victim for their own victimization, what we see with men. So we will actually, when we talk a lot about equity, diversity, inclusion, so we will actually lead by the standards in the family violence and intimate partner violence area. As for the resources, there are some resources available. If actually right now there is a growing interest to this. So male victimization, if you Google this, you will find very good resources in the United States. There is a resource center in California that collects, it's called Domestic Violence Project, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Domestic Violence Project that collects information on male victims of domestic violence. There are very many different resources available there, including podcasts, literature, papers, seminars. If you Google my publications, you can see with whom I publish, and this is how you can see so much more about the work we do in Canada, United States, United Kingdom. And then right now, I'm happy to inform that I was just a core organizer of the first international conference on men and families last week in Toronto. I've just returned. And I was so happy to see around 100 people, all of us who work in this field. So we actually shared experiences, and we will be creating a website with all the resources we have, with the names, with the publications. And of course, if you have any interest, any of the listeners have any interest in getting any publications, you would like to know more about it, please contact me. I can send you a paper because I know not all of you get access to the research publications, and I can direct you to other available resources. And in general, what I know is that all of us who work in this field are very willing to share the resources and papers and point you to a direction when you can get help and simply learn more about this issue. Thank you.
I will make sure that when I post the archive for the radio show on the webpage at cjsf.ca, that you links to find you are also there if folks want to follow up. My guest today has been Dr. Alexandra Lisova, professor here in the criminology department at SFU, studying intimate partner violence, and especially with a focus on male victims of domestic violence. Thank you so much. So much food for thought there. And I really congratulate you on the conference, but also on your being awarded the Sterling Prize for your research, and hope that it just keeps on keeping on.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you too.